We will go ahead and call our meeting to order. One second here. We'll call our meeting. Oh, look at that. Just in time. Trustee Harris.
There he is.
There he is. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
Okay, welcome. Okay, we'll call our meeting to order. Roll call. Excuse me. Here. Trustee Genrich. Here. Trustee Atwood.
Here.
Trustee Green. Trustee Sampson.
Here.
Trustee Sampson.
Here.
Trustee Dart.
Here.
Trustee Harris. Trustee Harris is here. President here. All present and accounted for. Do I have a motion to modify or adopt the agenda?
Move to adopt as presented.
Second.
Trustee Harris. Second by Trustee Atwood. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion passes, thank you. Announcements. I'll make one announcement, and that is that we have just installed two new handicap accessible kayak launches, one on the East River and one on the Fox River. I have heard great things, and we received a thank you card today for that, which is very cool. And the pickleball courts are being used like crazy. So people are thanking us for putting money into the village and to keep Alloway a great place to live, work, and play. And the other announcements from staff.
Yep, you stole my thunder. I was going to announce about the kayak launches, but that's quite all right.
Well, why don't you fill us in a little more, Chris?
Sure. The two kayak launches, the second one was installed today at Green Isle Park, Kayakers Point. Both of those launches were funded through grant monies, paid almost 100% through the grant monies. A little bit of, like, our staff time, we got to do a little bit of work, but a very minimal amount of dollars to go into that. But, yes, we have received quite a few positive comments already, and the community is really excited about that.
Great, thank you. I even kayaked the East River last week.
It wasn't even there, Jim.
The river was.
How'd you get in?
I know, I just couldn't wait. I look forward to doing it again. Any other announcements? Brad, were you going to say something? No?
I have one. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Hearing none.
Yeah.
Trevor, you want to say something?
Okay. I just wanted to make the announcement that as of Friday, we have one additional historic district in the village. The Robinson Hill District, which is generally the Derby Lane neighborhood area, was listed to the State Register of Historic Places. The State Historic Preservation Review Board reviewed the nomination and approved it. And from here, it will go on to the National Park Service, and they have 90 days, I believe, to review and approve. So, that was a project that was about 3 years in the making, so I'm happy to see it end successfully.
Actually, good job, Trevor. Thanks. Yes, thank you.
One other thing I'd just like to say is that the Facebook post today regarding the community building and other things going on was really well done. So I don't know who did it, but it was nice.
I would agree. Any other announcements? Hearing none, we will move on to item number five, the public hearing. The public hearing is to consider the adoption of Ordinance 2020-05, repealing and recreating Chapter 475, Zoning of the Village of Alloway Municipal Code. This has been a long time coming. We've been working on this. The staff has been working very hard on this for quite a while. And we have some guests tonight who are going to go through the updated program, and then we'll open it up for any public comment.
Jim, can I just ask a question? I wasn't sure my public comment, is it after the hearing, or is it as a preface to that?
Is it about the code itself?
Yes.
You know, if you can you hang in there until after the presentation, or do you have to go?
I can hang in there until the after the presentation.
Okay, very good. Okay, I am now going to stop sharing my screen and let Leslie share hers. Okay, Leslie, or Kurt, whoever wants to go.
All right.
Trevor, did you want?
We flipped a coin. I won, so I'm getting to start. Good evening, Mr. President and trustees. My name is Kurt Bishop. I'm a principal with Duncan Associates. I've had the pleasure of working with my colleague Leslie. We'll meet in a minute, and your staff and your project steering committee, a couple of members of whom are in attendance tonight, including Penny and Mark. I'm going to give you, with Leslie's assistance, a pretty high-level overview of the new proposed zoning ordinance that we've come up with, working closely with your village staff and the project steering committee. Over the past, I guess it's been about a couple of years since we began this project in earnest. We're really happy with the results. We hope you share our enthusiasm for the final product and the direction it may set for the village, particularly for some of the newly developing mixed-use and commercial areas of the village. That's really an area where the proposed zoning ordinance is in marked contrast to the regulations that are in place today. And really one of the more exciting elements of the new ordinance. I'm going to have Leslie tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. I'm going to start by describing the process that we've undertaken over the past, as I say, about 24 months. We really had a set out in our proposal in response to the village's request for proposals, a five-page work program. We spent the first couple, 3 months really understanding the existing context, and by that I mean looking through the existing zoning regulations of the village, touring the village, getting a real sense of the physical layout, and talking with your staff and steerings and diagnostic stage. The result of that stage was a phase one report that set the general direction and recommendation for the new ordinance. Then the second phase was probably the lengthiest phase in the project, where we worked closely again with the steering committee to create the initial ordinance draft and zoning map. Once we had that fine-tuned, about a year into the project, we prepared it here. In the fall of last year, we began interest to kind of house there at Village Hall, discussed it with the Plan Commission, and took input and made some revisions in response to what we heard from all those various stakeholders, whether they're interested. as part of the adoption process. I'm having trouble, Leslie, cycling through the slides. Here's the general table of contents for the new ordinance. You'll note as you've had an opportunity to review it that it looks a fair bit different than the village's existing zoning ordinance, both in terms of its overall organization, its general format and page layout. But we believe that the organization in particular will provide you with a real durable framework going forward, as undoubtedly with any ordinance you're going to need to make amendments over time in response to changing conditions or issues that may arise. But we think this new organization will give you a good outline upon which to build and amend and revise over time. You can see there in Articles 2 through 6, we have all the basic zoning district provisions assigned to various large categories like residential, mixed use, overlay, special purpose districts. The other important part of when people think about zoning districts are, of course, the uses. So we've got an article with a consolidated table showing the various use and business and residential types allowed in the residential districts. The general development regulations that apply really throughout the village, not necessarily attached to the zoning district or zoning classification of land, can be found in Articles 8, 9, and 10, landscape, outdoor lighting type regulations, and of course the sign regulations in Article 10. The remainder of the new draft contains basically the administrative and procedural provisions, and it concludes in Article 15 with a glossary of terms and measurement-related concepts that are important for administering, enforcing, and understanding the various provisions of the draft. We believe that could you go back to the project objective slide, Leslie? I'm sorry, yeah, I think I skipped over that. Thank you. I want to hand this off to Leslie, but I kind of want to tell you what the big ideas were at the outset of this project. And these were partly identified in the request for proposals that we responded to in order to be selected for this project. And of course, one of the key objectives was to modernize the village zoning ordinance. It really hadn't been comprehensively looked at for several, get back to the most of the provisions in the existing Chapter 475 date back to the 1970s. And there have been a lot of changes in the village. You've adopted a number of new directions in how development and land use changes should be accommodated in the village. So another key objective was to align or make the regulations consistent with and help to implement those various plans and studies. I'm talking about the comprehensive plan, the corridor study for Riverside Drive and Webster Avenue, the streetscape concept work that's been prepared, provided really helpful and an important framework for our work in making adjustments and in proposing new concepts in this. I'll walk you through in a minute. Is very exciting because it was really built from the ground up and is meant to recognize that the village has a unique character within the region and something that should be sort of built upon and enhanced over time. So writing new mixed-use regulations to reflect that village, the village's character, was really one of the really key jumping off points for the ordinance drafting work. We've also endeavored within the residential areas of the village, the zoned residential areas, to ensure that we are offering flexibility in a range of housing types that will meet the needs of, you know, various demographic groups and changes in the village, different ages, incomes, lifestyle choices. And then finally, whenever we're working on land development type regulations that you'll find in this zoning ordinance, we're always endeavoring to make sure that we present these regulations in a way that's easy to use and understand and navigate, whether you're an architect, an engineer, an attorney, a member of the village staff, or whether you're just a member of the public who encounters these types of rules and regulations but once or twice in their life, and should be able to kind of navigate your way to figure out what the rules are for the addition that you want to make to your house, or modifications or improvements you want to make to the shed or detached garage in the rear yard. So we're always trying to make those regulations as easy to use and understand as possible. So we're going to begin the substantive part of it tonight by handing the baton off to Leslie. She's going to walk you through some of the with regard to zoning of what were formerly thought of as commercial and industrial areas of the village, and thinking about those more in terms of mixed-use walkable areas.
So thank you for having us, and we're very excited to present this to you and to finish up this project to the extent that it gets adopted. As Kirk was saying, I'm going to really talk to you tonight about the mixed-use zones that we've created for, and zone districts that we've created for Alloway. Because those are the districts that are the most different from what you currently have on your books. The residential districts, the R1 and R2 zones, Kirk is going to talk to you about. So those are the majority of the village in the sort of light yellow and light green, the light green being the public and institutional zones. So he will present those to you. I'm going to talk mainly about the zones kind of at the top of the map legend. All of them are to some extent mixed use zones, and you could tell that by the X that's located within the name of the zone. The first three are called MX zones, MX1, MX2, and MXR. The MX1 zone is this sort of deep dark purple that is really meant to implement the streetscape concepts and the Webster Avenue and Riverside Drive cities, and that sort of goal of creating at St. Joseph and Webster Avenue right here in the middle of the village. The MX2 zone is what we're calling the neighborhood mixed-use zone, and that's a smaller scale mixed-use zone that would have retail and commercial on the ground floor and would allow for upper-story residential kind of on the outer edges, either along this northern portion of Webster Avenue or at what we call the kind of neighborhood nodes within the village. The MXR zone, and that R after at the end, meaning along the river or along Riverside Drive, is a mixed-use zone that takes into consideration the idea that you have both a frontage on Riverside Drive and really a frontage along the river as well. The GX zones, the two GX zones, the plain GX and then the GXR, which is the GX along the river, those are mainly residential and office zones. So they don't require ground story, storefront, and they aren't intended to really have that kind of shopping, retail, restaurant aspect that you would have on the ground floor of the MX zones. So it's really kind of more the urban fabric of the village, the buildings, residential buildings or townhouses within this zone, kind of working together. So they tend to be transitional areas between the more mixed-use commercial areas and the residential areas. So this is kind of the transition into the residential that you see with this light blue. Then the NX is the new multifamily or housing mix. It is really mainly residential, but it does have a mix of housing types allowed within it. So apartment buildings and townhouses. To kind of walk you through what the structure of these mixed use or X zones are. And as I said, Kirk will present the R and the P zones to you. So the structure of the mixed-use districts is building type spaced. And throughout the work that I've been doing over the last decade or so, I have found that building types are readily understandable by the average person. So when you go into a community and you start to talk about your storefront or your main street style buildings, people really get a vision of what the expectation is and can understand when you're talking about a townhouse or a row house building. And so what we've tried to do is identify really the people within these mixed-use districts. So as I was saying, the sort of storefront district, the storefront building type that would be more retail, shopping, restaurants, consumer uses, and then upper story residential or office, but in a structure that looks like this. It has that kind of ground floor glass and entrances along the street. The upper stories have, and then the parking is located in the rear or sometimes to the side. The commercial cottage is a building type that I also find across the country, and this is really some of what's happening on the north end of Webster, where houses have been converted into residential, or, as you see here, or new construction commercial that is smaller in scale and tends to have that pitched roof and that kind of residential feel. That is the type of building in addition to a small-scale storefront that we anticipate in the neighborhood mixed-use district, the MX2. The general building is just that. It's a general building that has kind of a basic requirement for a storefront, for windows or transparency on all stories of the building. Without that requirement for the additional glass that you would have on the ground floor of the storefront. But again, it has that kind of orientation to the street, but it for area between the building and the street. It always houses office and residential very well. And it can house either pretty comfortably. So that would be the building that you would see the most in the GX zones in the city, in the village. And then the row building is really just about that kind of vertical orientation of a unit side by side. And it could be more of a row house structure or a townhouse structure or even live work, where some of the ground floor could be used for offices or other kind of commercial endeavors, and then the owner might live above. So the general building and the row building being in the GX. Kirk, do you have control? It says Kirk is controlling your screen. The fifth building type is kind of
one of those buildings,
and as I was saying, as I was saying before, it creates both a frontage along the river and a frontage along Riverside Drive, or in the case in the northern part, a smaller scale street that might be parallel to Riverside Drive. So this is an example of a building that's not too much further north of you all, and it does a great job of this. Although it is a pretty massive building, the building that we have sort of illustrated for the riverfront is not quite as large as I was saying. So an orientation, not turning its back to the river, having people space and windows, obviously, that face the river. So the riverfront building being kind of a version of the general building and the storefront building. So on page 3.3 in the code, there is this table, which is really the key to the mixed-use or X districts. So it aligns those building types that I just mentioned, and then it says which ones are permitted in which zone district. The other building type that I didn't really discuss is the civic building type, and that's because that is really limited to its use, only for civic and institutional uses such as a religious assembly building or an village hall or a library or a museum or something like that, something that has a kind of increased status in terms of its civic value to the community. That building type is just a much more flexible building type, which would allow you to have, you know, a list architect come in and design something for you within reason in the civic building. But it has more control over it in that it is limited to those specific uses. So again, the storefront building with the ground floor storefront glass is in MX1 and MX2. So the village center, and then the neighborhood mixed use, like the north end of Webster and some of the neighborhood commercial nodes. The commercial cottage is combined with the storefront are the two sort of main building types in the MX2 neighborhood mixed use. The general building being allowed in the GX, as well as the commercial cottage in a more sort of office form in the GX. And then in the GX, the MXR and the GXR, the riverfront buildings. Then the row building in all of the MXR, GXR, GX, so pretty much everywhere except for in the mixed-use kind of centers. So each one of those building types then has a set of pages that is associated with it, with the regulations, the majority of the regulations for it. So what you're seeing on the screen is three pages of the storefront building type. So we started out showing examples of the storefront building, and then on the following two pages, there's a series of tables with the regulations for the storefront building that are different in the MX1 and different in the MX2, so columns based on the zone districts. Each one of these regulations is then keyed to an illustration. The building and parking siding regulations that locate the building to the street in relationship to the street and then in relationship to the river for the riverfront building. The parking location behind the building or screened from the primary street by the building. And then just some basic regulations regarding impervious site coverage or just general coverage what is called occupied space, meaning that you're intended to have actual people space on the main streets, so garages not located up to the streets. Then the second section of regulations is all about height, key to a section through a building. Where the ground story of a storefront is intended to be taller because usually that's required by those types of uses. And we're managing the height, overall height of the building by the number of stories with a floor-to-floor height for each story. The last section is all about the facade design, and that is really the key difference between conventional regulations and these types of regulations. And so what we're intending to show here is that you have a certain amount of window transparency required per story. And then in this particular case, there's a special ground story treatment for the storefront glass, and that is delineated in the table. Different for MX1 as it is from MX2. It's a little bit lower for MX2 in the neighborhood mixed-use location. Finally, we have a building cap. And so the intent here is that we are treating the ground story of the building very specifically to the pedestrian. That's what the pedestrian is interacting with. And then we are capping the building. And then in between, the middle is being treated with a certain amount of transparency to encourage that kind of activity that you might see in the evenings or when the ground floor is closed. So each one of the building types has this set of three pages. So when someone is going to design or construct it, there's a pretty specific location where they can go and get all of the information pretty quickly, in addition to the parking and signs and landscape requirements in the other sections. So I've already kind of walked you through each one of these to illustrate how those tables are broken down. One thing that I want to point out in terms of the building and parking siding is that within the mixed-use zones, we are using a build-to zone, meaning that this sort of yellow zone, the building must be built within it. So it must touch that build-to zone, as opposed to a setback line, which would be a line that you would be required to build the building somewhere beyond. So this is one of the ways that we manage that parking is located in the rear and that the buildings are built closer to the street. And what that does is when you're walking down the street in the village center, then you're experiencing what is called the street wall or the facades of the building as you're walking along it. So it's sort of drawing you down the street. It's also enclosing the street into a sort of smaller scale so that you feel more comfortable when you're walking. I will say that the build-to zones for Alloway, because this is one of the things that we discussed with the steering committee and one of the characteristics of your community, the build-to zone is deeper than it would be in a more urban location. So this idea that you have, you know, up to 20 feet in front of the building to allow for that streetscape that was in the streetscape plan, in many other places where it's more urban and not as villagey, you might only have a 0 to 5 foot zone there. So this is just one example of how we're building in the character of Alloway into these building types. So as I said, stories are... the number of stories is how we measure the height, and then there is a floor-to-floor dimension for the stories. And the storefront is the only one where the ground story is a taller height than the upper floors. Facade and cap requirements are generally about transparency, which is windows and openings, entrances along the street, and then a little bit about facade divisions, just to break up the facades into smaller, more human scale implements, and then the cap types. So we also have, so as I was just saying, building and parking siding, height and stories, windows, doors, and roofs. We also have a section called building design regulations, which discusses facade materials. We had, probably Penny can attest, we had a lot of discussion about materials in our steering committee meetings and tried to kind of pinpoint the materials that you all would regularly ask for on new construction to make sure that we're making it as easy as possible for the developer to design the buildings the way that you would ask for them to be designed with that distinctive list of building materials. And then there is also a set of building details, things such as balconies and basic window design, in the building design section, and also in the building design section, the location of mechanical equipment, making sure that you're not putting it in that streetscape area between the building and the street. You're locating it in an appropriate place where it's screened. You can see that the commercial cottage has a pitched roof. It has a lower amount of transparency. It does have a maximum building width associated with it, but we have also allowed it to have connections between the buildings that are set back and a lower in scale than the overall building, so that you could connect up a series of commercial cottages in the future or for a larger occupant, but in that still having that character of that small scale feel. And the riverfront building, as discussed, the sort of storefront design and the general building design, looking at ways to incorporate primary streets instead of just using Riverside Drive, so that you could do a side street that has frontage and then frontage along the river as well. This is the building design regulations that I referred to, the table of building materials, also windows, balconies, awnings, etc. And then an element of the code, the new code that probably won't get used a lot, but is available for potential redevelopment of larger sites within the village, 3 acres or larger. We've created this master development plan, or MDP overlay, which is it's sort of like a mini PUD that's a little bit, or PD, that's already sort of set up. It has a series of maximum block sizes. It has a street section. It has requirements for open space, usable open space types. And it would use the zoning districts that are on the books so that a larger site could redevelop with new blocks in streets, and locating your current zoning districts on the site so that it would fold well into your zoning map and then would follow the building type regulations. So we have found that this is a great tool for encouraging good design at a larger scale, and a little bit of subdivision regulation associated with this. And I'm going to turn it over to Kirk.
Thanks, Leslie. Leslie, go to that next slide and show that zoning map again, if you would, please. So, Leslie showed the zoning map earlier. I wanted to revisit it. I just want to remind us how much of the existing village is currently zoned in a residential classification, either what is today referred to as the A district or the B district or the, I guess there's that also in that high density district. I would say 75 to 80% of the village falls within, outside of those X or mixed use classifications that Leslie just described, and are more generally thought of as residential, or they contain some public or semi-public type facility. So I'm going to start by telling you our approach to those residential areas on the zoning map. Today, most of, if you could go back a slide, Leslie, now, or to go backwards one, please. That A zoning classification, which of the residential is the, by and large, the single most prevalent classification in the village, requires, it's basically a single, or typically thought of as a single-family detached house zoning classification. The existing requirements call for a 75-foot lot, and I think of a 7,500 square feet of minimum lot area in order to be able to use those. As we evaluated the existing zoning map and did some measurements, we determined that there were several areas in the village that were platted for residential use were devoted to residential houses, single family, by and large, that were that didn't comply with or were under the 75 foot lot width frontage or 7,500 square feet of lot area. And so one of the things that we've proposed in this new ordinance is the creation of a new single family, smaller lot zoning classification. We call it the R150, denoting single family residential R1 on a 50 foot lot, or 40 foot lot actually, with a 5,000 square feet of minimum lot area. And that would be the north end of the village, kind of the older area adjacent to Green Bay at the north end, and then some pockets elsewhere around the village where we found that lot areas were deficient to meet that 7,500 square foot requirement in the existing ordinance. So suffice to say we have an R175, which is equivalent to today's A district, and a new R150 classification. We've also carried over the existing two-family or two-unit house classification. I think that's the existing B district. We're proposing that in addition to duplexes, which are two dwelling units on a single lot, that the R2 classification would also allow what are commonly referred to as twin houses or twindos, which are kind of equivalent to townhouses, but only two units attached, typically with a lot line down the middle. So a subtle distinction between a twin house and a duplex, but an important one in terms of what builders might need to go through in order to build those types of housing units on lots. We've proposed a substantive change that I want to bring to your attention, and that is the elimination of the existing ordinance's minimum dwelling size regulations. Most of the residential classifications today establish a minimum house size or apartment size classification. They're fairly nominal. I think they were maybe geared towards a different time and maybe an effort to limit where one could put manufactured housing units or mobile homes. In our experience, those kinds of minimum dwelling size restrictions are kind of going by the wayside. In today's world, I think we're finding that the size of a house or in sheer square footage is not always an accurate indication or determinant of the value of the structure. And those kinds of regulations can also work against the creativity of builders and work against some of your objectives about accommodating a range of housing types for different incomes and age groups. So for those reasons, we've proposed that those regulations not be carried over into this proposed new ordinance. And on the same theme of accommodating a variety of housing types and sizes, we've proposed the addition of an important new concept that is sometimes referred to broadly as an accessory dwelling unit, ADU for short, sometimes referred to as granny flats or carriage houses. In our new proposed ordinance, we define two types of these ADUs or accessory dwelling units, backyard cottages and secondary suites. Backyard cottages being pretty much what they sound, small detached structures typically located in the rear yard of a lot occupied by a single family detached house. And a secondary suite being not detached but contained within the overall principal building or principal single family dwelling, but a space carved out for a secondary small dwelling unit within the overall building that contains the single family. It could be an addition, could be attic space, in some cases it could be a basement apartment, or simply area that's been sort of cordoned off from the main dwelling unit that may have a separate entrance and would accommodate a secondary suite. As you might imagine, when we held the open houses, we had a great deal of interest in learning more about what the backyard cottage and secondary suite concept could mean, and I think it's accurate to say we received pretty favorable response. If you would go to the slide that talks a bit more about that, Leslie. There we go. Few things to keep in mind that these backyard cottages and secondary suites, and you would only be able to allow one of those forms of accessory dwelling unit on a single lot. So you couldn't have a backyard cottage and a secondary suite and a principal single-family detached house on a lot. At most, you would have a single-family detached house and either a backyard cottage or a secondary suite. They're only allowed on lots occupied by a detached house. The owner must live on the premises, on the subject lot, either in the principal dwelling unit or the smaller accessory dwelling unit, as might be the case in an older resident seeking to move to smaller space and maybe rent out to a family member or not the larger house, or vice versa. The detached form of an accessory dwelling unit, what we're calling the backyard cottage, is limited in size and scale and square footage, no more than 700 square feet. Secondary suites couldn't take up more than 25% of the overall floor area of the principal building. So with those caveats, we've recommended that these accessory dwelling units be a new housing option within the village's residential zoning districts. This is a phenomenon that is really taken hold nationally, and I've worked on a couple of codes in Wisconsin where this concept has been adopted in Wauwatosa and most recently in Mount Pleasant. I worked on code updates there that included the accessory dwelling unit concept. I don't think either of those municipalities has had a lot of experience yet in our other client communities outside of Wisconsin. I think it's accurate to say that although people are interested in the concept, there have been few kind of deployments or use or people taking advantage of it. We all know that it's expensive in today's world to build about anything, let alone a fully operational small dwelling unit, be it small or large. So I don't think it hasn't been the case where the accessory dwelling units have, on the day an ordinance has been adopted, have caught on like wildfire and there's a rush to the permit window to do it. But we think it's really important to have this accessory dwelling unit option in the ordinance. It really helps to add to the village's housing stock without necessarily, in a really gentle way, without sort of changing the character of your residential neighborhoods by building big buildings in the middle of neighborhoods. So it adds to the housing stock while preserving the neighborhood character. It provides an additional housing option, which can be really important for seniors and folks who want to remain in their existing neighborhood but are looking for to maybe downsize or get somebody on the property to help them with overall maintenance. It can really be important, too, we've seen in recent years with in terms of younger college-age kids who maybe move home for a year or two or they're trying to get on their feet and looking for that kind of independent space on the lot maybe of their parents' house. And, of course, when we're talking about just building in our existing neighborhoods, we're really making efficient use of existing infrastructure without sort of sprawling out into the farm fields necessarily. So those are the reasons behind it. It's been pretty thoroughly vetted both by our steering committee, certainly by staff, and then in the open houses that we've held. And as I say, generally been pleased with the reaction we've got. So moving on from the residential, those are the key changes. We showed on the zoning map some green shaded areas. That's a new zoning classification. There's really two of them, two public and institutional type zoning districts that are meant to accommodate things like schools, churches, parks, and larger campus scale facilities like the prison, the Green Bay Correctional Institution, are zoned in either the P1 or P2 classifications. And these are just meant to provide a signal on the zoning map that this area is zoned for something other than residential or mixed use, and provides a pretty clear indication to neighbors that something else might occur there, or that the land is zoned for something else. And it also makes the regulations a little easier to use for public and institutional entities who own property within the village. On the right side of this slide, I have an excerpt from the consolidated use table, which I touched on briefly earlier. This is a table that shows, for all of the zoning classifications in the village, the land use types that are permitted, and includes a link to the definition of the residential type and any kind of special conditions or standards that might apply to that land use in one or more of the zoning districts. We've also attempted to modernize the definitions and terminology used, getting away from highly detailed lists of sometimes antiquated business types and grouping things into categories that are commonly understood: office, retail, eating and drinking establishments, lodging, and that sort of classification that I think will be easier for staff to use and administer over time, and to categorize new business types when they come into the permit counter in terms of where they're permitted within the village. In terms of the generally applicable regulations, including parking, the parking regulations have been modernized, updated, often resulting in some reduction in the required minimum ratios, the number of parking spaces per 1,000 square feet that you might need to provide for a commercial or business type use, in some cases has been reduced. We've included some nominal minimum bicycle parking requirements for larger types of uses that are likely to generate customer or employee related bicycle trips that I think will dovetail nicely with the village's efforts to accommodate non-motorized travel, trail systems, and so forth. One substantive change I want to bring to your attention is an existing requirement that calls for, I think, geared towards multifamily and apartment type projects, that some percentage of the parking required for those multifamily type facilities be in garage or in covered parking spaces. And as we reviewed that and thought about the cost implications and reviewed kind of best practices from elsewhere, we've proposed that requirement be eliminated going forward. Drive-through facilities, we've included some basic minimum requirements for the number of stacking spaces to ensure that the establishments with drive-through windows, whether they're banks or restaurants or pharmacies, have some on-site capacity to accommodate vehicles waiting at the drive-up window or at the delivery window without queuing out into the public right-of-way. The requirements are fairly nominal, but are missing entirely from the existing ones. Go ahead, cycle on. Landscape and screening, another one of those generally applicable regulations, added some new requirements for the planting of street trees and the planting of trees within larger parking lots in the village. Sign regulations we've kind of collected sign regulations, which are sprinkled throughout the zoning ordinance, consolidated them in one place, reorganized them, and kind of cleaned them up in terms of complying with changes in federal law and court decisions related to First Amendment issues and signs. So we think we've got you a set of sign regulations that are tracking basically what you do today, but have removed some of the provisions which could be interpreted as content-based and not allowed because of First Amendment concerns. So it's kind of a legalese issue. The administrative and procedural provisions, we've consolidated, again, all of the various requirements for conditional uses, rezonings, variances, put them into a single article where they can be presented kind of in a flow as the process generally occurs. Put some flow charts in there to indicate to casual users what the process generally looks like. We've updated the site plan review procedures. You know, Leslie described those new mixed-use regulations and showed you the charts and the diagrams. Because of the clarity and sort of predictability that those regulations really embody, we think that site plan review in the future for a lot of projects could occur at the administrative and staff level, thereby streamlining the process, condensing the amount of time required for investors and developers to take projects through the village, yet reserving the opportunity to have a more robust public process involving plan commission and or village board review for projects that are asking for some kind of relief or an exception to the regulations that are presented. So that would be an example of something that I think is going to provide some streamlining and also provide appropriate outlets for higher level public reviews of projects. The nonconformity regulations, like the sign regulations, have been buffed up a little bit to comply with changes in this case, in terms of the Wisconsin statutes. There been a couple of tweaks over the years that have occurred in there. The enforcement provisions, again, basically a consolidation and really trying to expand the options that the village has for pursuing efforts to achieve voluntary compliance with the zoning regulations. And with that, we wanted to give you, I apologize for taking so much of your time, but you know, this is an important milestone for the village. We want to make sure we draw your attention to the significant changes and welcome any questions or thoughts that you might have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kirk and Leslie. Nice job. Let me make a slight change here. So you're done sharing, correct? At least at this point in time. You know what? I'll leave your there in case we have questions. I was going to unmute everyone, but okay. I'm going to ask everyone to unmute. And I know from a public hearing perspective, I know Mark wanted to talk. So, Mark, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just fine, sir.
Okay, well, thank you. So, yeah, my name's Mark Schumacher. I feel like I know a lot of you. I'm a long time, almost a lifetime Helloway resident. I serve on the Economic Development Committee and was invited to serve on that steering committee. So met with Duncan Associates and Leslie and Kirk to listen and to provide feedback and opinions as this process moved forward. So I think you all can see from seeing what they walked through, what an enormous effort it is. It's something that was really outdated, and so it really required a competent professional service to guide that process. And as kind of a public or resident perspective, they just proved to really be experienced experts. And what what impressed me the most, I think, was that they really took serious time to research and identify the characteristics which define Alloway and make us who we are. And rather than just imposing their expertise, they sought to enhance and improve our existing strengths that we already enjoy and provide sensible guidelines that anticipate healthy development in the future. So, you know, in layman's terms, the codes and the publication provide a clear template for building and planning standards, which are, they're sensible, they're flexible, and they're sensitive to our existing landscape of Alloway. So, and it also aligns really well with the goals of the comprehensive plan in a way that I think will really preserve our identity over time. And I think just, you see the publication, you take all that information, and it really needs to be formatted and organized in a way that's not intimidating. It can, it's something that an average person like me can look at and understand and walk through. So I think that's really reflects on Alloway well and on Duncan Associates. So I was invited to sit in and ask questions, provide input, and it really gave me a unique chance to gain insight into how these processes work. So you know, there's a bit of a public perception, I think, that there's waste and hidden agendas in government, even at village levels, and I wish more residents or people in Alloway would have opportunities to serve in small ways like I did, because they'd see that we have really good leadership, and they're accountable, and they care about things that matter. So I'd just like to say thank you to Kirk and Leslie, and to Brad, Trevor and Penny, and anyone who had a part in this effort in the board. So thank you for letting me be a part of that, and for allowing me to share my perspective.
Thank you very much, Mark. Well said, and much appreciated. Thank you for everything you do for the village as well, and thanks for taking the time to share your thoughts.
You're welcome. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
And we have one more visitor, I believe, and that is JJP's iPad. JJP, would you like to say something? I'll invite you to unmute. Make sure he or she has an opportunity. Okay. Just sent a chat. And if not, we will. Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to speak during the public hearing? Hearing none, we will thank Leslie and Kirk very much for your presentation. If you'd like to hang around, we are going to address the zoning code in the next time. So, I am going to stop your sharing. Okay, here we go. Can everyone see the agenda on my screen?
No.
No?
I can't.
Okay, hold on. One chat. Oh, okay. Lynn is trying to unmute. Hold on one second. I wish I could unmute you, but I'm asking you to oh, wait, you're unmuted.
I'm unmuted.
What would you like to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think the plan's very good. I have a question regarding... regarding trees, of course. So we've been Tree City USA for a long time, and I just want to make sure that we're not... What I've noticed around town is a lot of the island parking lot size is getting fairly small, and to plant large-sized trees that we're taking into account, those either need to be ornamental trees, because it's really sad to me when they start putting in landscaping with trees not taking into account full-size trees. So, Chris, this one from, you know, a parks and forestry standpoint, one of the things our residents that I heard really liked was the amount of trees and greenscaping we have, and just make sure that some of that stays. And please don't take this as anything bad. I absolutely love the plan and how we're making it more walkable and livable. But one of the things that the boulevards go, when we do have the larger sections, trees give a break from that traffic and from pedestrians on that walk. And we do have some areas where we can't do that, but I like that you've taken the couple acre parcels, and where we can, we're going to try to. So it's a long way to say my concern is trees.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for sharing. Okay, we will go on to... Now, can you see the agenda?
Yes.
Okay. We will close the public hearing and move on to action item number 6, action regarding adoption of ordinance 2020-05, repealing and recreating Chapter 475 of the Zoning Code. Do I have a motion on this item?
Move to approve.
That was trustee.
I'll second.
Trustee Genrich, seconded by trustee Dart. Any discussion? I would just like to commend everyone on a job well done and look forward to a lot of use of our new zoning code. We have any other discussion?
President Raptor, just a side note, Matthew here is just unable to unmute.
Okay, hold on.
And can Chris answer my question about the trees? This still puts us on track to still maintain our Tree City USA. And the thing is, it's not just the Tree City USA part, but trees absorb stormwater runoff. They help with warming with asphalt areas, et cetera, et cetera.
Matthew, you're not allowed. I'm sorry, Matthew, you're not allowed to unmute.
Trevor cannot either. Trevor cannot mute.
Trevor and Chris haven't.
Oh, and Chris can't either.
Okay, I'm going to ask everyone to unmute. Chris.
I have to say, I absolutely love the accessory building units. Because as a nurse practitioner who is dealing with an adult geriatric population, being able to have seniors age in place is huge, and I think this will allow the flexibility to do it.
Okie doke.
I want to ask a quick question. I hadn't noticed, and maybe it was just because I didn't know to look for it, but up until Kirk brought up the stuff about no minimum dwelling size, I'm just trying to understand a little bit better behind that thought process. I don't know, do we, in this situation, someone could tear down their house and then rebuild a 400-square-foot home, and there wouldn't be an issue with someone doing that as their main dwelling?
Under the proposal set forth, by eliminating the minimum size restrictions from the zoning ordinance, the only thing that would govern the absolute minimum smallest size would be the building code. There are certain restrictions in the building code for occupiable space, but they're fairly nominal. The reasoning is that in a mature, in our experience, in a mature housing market, land values are going to help to dictate that within an existing, particularly an existing neighborhood context, that the likelihood of that kind of worst-case scenario is pretty minimal. The other thing that we've observed in other jurisdictions that have grappled with whether to retain these is they do have some effect on, again, the flexibility of a design professional or a builder or a consumer about maybe designing a more well-designed, smaller space. And those kinds of regulatory obstacles were something that we thought and had recommended for elimination from the ordinance. So your theoretical concern or the hypothetical that you propose is something that I can't deny couldn't happen. We think it's really unlikely, and that the benefits of eliminating may outweigh that negative potential. But that's certainly, as a policymaker, that's a decision for you. I just wanted to bring it to your attention and not overlook something that you may think is important going forward.
And thank you. I appreciate that. As part of the presentation was going on, I started backtracking to the existing code, and I saw you've got to have 100 square feet of dwelling space per person. There's something about 490 cubic feet of airspace in a bedroom. That's what we have existing. Again, didn't see anything like that in the future, which I don't understand. I don't know if we necessarily have to have certain airspace, but I don't. If we were to pass with my hypothetical, there would be nothing to prevent it from happening, like you said. And if someone just decided to do that with the land, it's obviously their land, but the neighbors would have no recourse. They would be, for lack of better words, stuck with it. And I just want to make sure I bring it up and see if everyone else is okay with that idea.
And Kirk, is that correct?
Yes. By eliminating the requirements, there would be no grounds for denial of a permit for a smaller dwelling unit on a single lot, and no grounds for a neighbor to appeal or oppose that decision that the village would typically have grounds to stand upon. It was on the basis, again, additionally, I'm glad that Matt mentioned the existing requirements. They're fairly ineffective in their current form about preventing that kind of worst-case scenario, and they're a little bit difficult to administer in terms of cubic volume and things like that. So that was another reason that we had proposed their elimination.
Matthew, is your concern arch homes or smaller homes being built?
Smaller. And I completely understand the likelihood is minimal, but I'm just visualizing myself, if what would it look like if in the traditional neighborhood, the established neighborhood, if someone just decided to put up a 400 square foot house, how out of place would that look? Balancing that with, it's someone's land, they can do what they want. Those are the rules, they're following the rules. Here's where we're establishing the rules. Do we want to put in any kind of threshold?
Okay. Any other discussion on that?
Well, to Matthew's point, too, something that's becoming popular across the country are these shipping containers, being converted into not just storage units, but mini homes. So, like 200 square feet, some of them might be 300 square feet. Now, we can say that there's some really cool ones out there that you would welcome, but there's also many out there that aren't. So where do you draw the line? Is a storage container, can it be considered as a home if retrofitted?
That's really an issue that's addressed in the building code. If it meets state building code requirements, it's theoretically possible. There's nothing in the zoning per se. The zoning addresses the use of shipping containers as storage units, And we've proposed some fairly robust standards because that can be problematic if they're in place a long time in a residential neighborhood. But it doesn't specifically address the use of alternative building materials or storage containers being an example as a residential dwelling, again, subject to some pretty stringent requirements that the building code as opposed to the zoning might contain. And Trevor, you probably far better versed than I in that if I misstated something.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say almost the same thing. Kevin and I have spoken about that issue. There would be some major retrofits that would have to take place in order for something like that to take place. Not to say it would never happen, but they would have to really do some major alterations to the shipping container in order to make it functional.
And we have small homes today, right? And I do think it's unlikely if someone wanted to buy a big home in Alloway, pay the price to buy that home, level it to put up a smaller home.
That's a camp.
I would think that would be unlikely. Normally you'd probably buy, if you wanted to build a new smaller home, you'd probably buy a new smaller lot unless you just wanted more land. They still have to build to our standards, right?
Right, and I guess one other thing to add, there's nothing in the code today that would prohibit them from doing the same thing as long as they met the minimum dwelling requirement that we have in place. So they could essentially bring in two or three of those shipping containers today and potentially do the same thing.
Well, to that point, I believe it was maybe 12, 18 months ago, I brought this up at a meeting as well, that these storage containers are becoming popular and if we have anything in place to regulate, monitor, prohibit them. You know, I mean, I would hate to see my neighbor put two of them in the backyard and call it a mini home or in-laws quarter or and retrofit it, etc. I don't know. Yeah, unlikely. Probably not as unlikely as knocking down a home and putting up too many homes. But Matthew's got a very valid point. I'm just saying that these storage units are becoming more and more popular, especially in the medium to major metros. You know, and do we want to start having some of our bigger lots start plopping those in the backyard and retrofitting them? I understand that there's concern, you know, a lot of modifications would have to be made, but we want that.
Okay, Matthew?
One of the things we could do is, because not just because, but with all the work that's been put into this, we you know, make a mental note, for lack of better words, if we get an instance where something's not fitting the ideal, the plan, whether it's the shipping containers, we can make a switch to the zoning, albeit there'd be one instance of it happening, but we just have to pay attention to it.
Rob? I would agree.
One thing that might ease your concern, Rob, about using a shipping container as a backyard cottage is there's two measures that we put in place as we discussed this, both at the steering committee level amongst staff and then with the planning commission. One is that with the backyard cottage, you would need a conditional use permit to allow that. So there'd be some degree of awareness that we would be, that the neighbors would at least be made aware about it. The other thing that we added was, I believe we added something in there that the material had to be consistent with the primary structure.
That's right, Trevor. For the detached units, the backyard cottage as opposed to the secondary suite, there is a requirement that it generally match the materials and roof lines of the principal building, with an eye towards ensuring that it's not really disruptive to the overall neighborhood character. And I'm glad you mentioned the conditional use. That probably is the safeguard. While I couldn't give Matt and Jim the safeguard that about the tearing down the principal building and building a smaller house on the lot would be kind of something that the village wouldn't have a strong review or discretion about, the backyard cottage is something the village has pretty broad discretion about. And plans would be submitted with the conditional use, and you'd be able to sort of question material and design kind of proposals at that process. So that's something you have much greater discretion on in terms of approving the backyard cottage as the conditional use.
The conditional use clause makes that absolutely clear then.
Okay, so does that address questions, concerns, Matthew and Rob, or?
It does for me. Thank you very much for the extra explanation.
I would echo that. Thank you.
Okay. Great discussion. Thank you for bringing it up. Is there any other? Trustee Sampson?
Yeah, maybe I would start this question with Trevor. But when I joined the board, I heard an awful lot about PDDs, and you know, there was a citizen or two, maybe just one, who complained and criticized that we use them too often. Now that is this either written out or is it made more unlikely that we would ever use that process? And just a kind of a devil's advocate question, is anything lost because that's no longer available, if in fact it's no longer available?
I'll take an attempt at that answer, but would also welcome Kirk or Leslie to chime in as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, essentially we have eliminated that through the new code. There are some different levels of exceptions that we've provided in the code to provide some flexibility where needed or necessary as far as certain design exceptions or something like that. And those design exceptions, if they would have to go through either the Planning Commission and or the Village Board in order to achieve if they're major in scale. If they're minor in scale, at least staff has some discretion on that, but for the most part, it would need to come before either the Planning Commission or the Village Board. And we have gotten rid of that because we've done a better job identifying what we want and the standards that we want met, I guess.
Okay. It was pretty clear that our old way of relying so heavily on that was not modern zoning and planning.
Yeah, I would echo that, Trustee Simpson. In our experience, overuse of the PDD or plan development type tool is a really solid indicator that it's time to update your ordinance. If the only way to accommodate new development going forward is to treat each development as a kind of one-off, very unpredictable system, very drawn-out process, then there's maybe something fundamentally wrong with the older code. And as I say, with a code from the 1970s, it's not surprising that that kind of approach was taken hold maybe a little too prevalently for some people's case. So we have eliminated, but as Trevor said, I think we've at the same time allowed enough flexibility in terms of the design exceptions that the Plan Commission and or Village Board could approve that that the ordinance will be very accommodating for the type of development desired by the village.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, is there any other discussion on that? We have a motion to approve and a second. Trustee Dart, what would you like to say?
I just wanted to say I thought Mark did an eloquent job, and I totally agree with him. So I thank you all, and Leslie, for, I think you were great. And zoning isn't as boring when you got pictures.
You're here. That's Leslie's work.
Okay, any other discussion?
Yeah. Chris, did you get unmuted to be able to answer my question?
I could try to answer that. This now gives us some ability to work with those new developments on, you know, requirements of vegetation and, you know, location and sizes and things like that. With regards to your comment about the, you know, for instance, the parking lot islands, a lot of, that I recommend, if that's the case, is there's always the perimeter of parking lots that can be utilized to provide, you know, those growing spaces as well, which typically gives, you know, trees more rooting capacity.
That's good, because most of the islands I've seen, the trees just die in a couple of years anyway, because there's just not enough space for water and roots. So does this give you enough space along the outside edges to still maintain the vegetation in a way?
Yes, because, you know, there's a balance there too, because there's requirements for instance, for a number of parking stalls that are required and that. But, overhead power lines are another challenge. But yes, that does give us, you know, a lot of room to, you know, work with those developments.
Excellent. Okay, so you brought up parking stalls, because that's another question. I know cars are getting smaller, but one of the things I'm cognizant of is we have had some developments that the parking stalls and parking numbers have been so small it has pushed traffic onto roads. And so I think we need to be cognizant of what the reality is and not pushing cars onto village roads that make it a problem for residents in transit or residents seeing corners, et cetera. So that's just another one of, and don't get me wrong, I absolutely, and I love that we put pictures with it, but it's definitely a concern because it's happened in a couple of other places. So I think we should be cognizant of that with new developments going forward as well.
Okay. Thank you for that. Anything else? Hearing none. We have a motion to approve, to repeal the current zoning code and recreating Chapter 475, the zoning code of the Village of Alloway Municipal Code. Do I have, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much, everyone, for your hard work. We move forward.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kirk. Leslie.
Yep. Kirk and Leslie, thank you very much.
Yeah, good presentation and discussion as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good discussion. Okay, moving on. Item number 7, action regarding resolution regarding wearing of face coverings in Alloway. Trustee Sampson spent some time putting together a proposed resolution, and I suggested some minor modifications or modifications to it, and so I will pull that one up. You should have all seen the resolution that was presented by Trustee Sampson, correct? It came out from Debbie today, but I'll pull up this one and share it with you. Nope, that's the wrong one. Crap. Excuse my language. There we go. Okay. I will attempt to share my screen. Okay. So
this is a red line version, so we can see what Chris presented in what I'm proposing. So the motion will be to approve the amended resolution. Wording it says, whereas the coronavirus pandemic continues to endanger public health with confirmed COVID-19 cases across Wisconsin and in Brown County, with significant risk for people in our community. Whereas leaders of the 5 local hospitals and major clinics, including chief executive officers of Aurora, Baycare Clinic, Bell and Health, HSHS St. Mary's, and HSHS St. Vincent Hospital, and Prevea Health, have urged local governments to address the issue of community-wide face covering ruling in order to help slow the spread of virus and avoid exceeding local health care capacity. Whereas a number of constituents have contacted their Alloway Village representatives to make known their support for their positions, both in favor and against mask requirements in Alloway. Whereas both Village and of Alloway Legal Counsel and officials with the Wisconsin League of Municipalities have expressed the opinion that those communities that do not operate their own public health departments, most small and mid-sized cities and villages across the state, including Alloway, are governed by any county or state directives with regard to the comprehensive and enforceable health orders. Whereas Governor Tony Evers mandated the use of masks in indoor public spaces in Wisconsin as of August 1 through September 30th, whereas we believe that Alloway businesses and residents are to be commended for their ongoing voluntary adherence to the best practices in social distancing, washing of hands, cleaning and disinfecting high-touch surfaces, and mask use where appropriate, even before the governor's mandate, and that these actions, according to the Brown County Health Department, are effective tools in preventing the spread of COVID-19. Whereas we believe that heightened vigilance is both possible and desirable in Alloway, given the continuing prevalence of COVID-19 infections. Therefore, be it resolved that we, the undersigned members of the Alloway Village Board, strongly recommend the voluntary washing of hands, cleaning and disinfecting of high-touch surfaces, and wearing face coverings where appropriate by residents of, visitors to, and businesses in the Village of Alloway, until such time that Brown County Health Department determines from COVID-19 case data that the pandemic has abated, or until the Brown County Health Department determines these measures are not effective in the abatement of COVID-19. Further, be it resolved that we continue to encourage a cohesive and comprehensive approach by the federal government, state, and county to avoid confusion from one community to another. Do I have a motion on this item?
President Rafter, I would move that we approve the version you just read with your amendments, with the exception of that one typo where a couple of words were repeated.
Yep. Okay.
I would move we approve this version.
Okay. Thank you. Do I have a second?
Matthew, I think your hand was up first, otherwise I will.
Doesn't matter.
Thank you, I didn't see it. Okay, I'm going to unshare my screen now. Okay, so Matthew had his hand up, seconded by Trustee Harris. Any discussion?
One other item quickly. It's
yes.
Semantics. In terms of the dates, instead of September 30th, it should be September 29th, I think. It's a 60-day order.
Okay, we will confirm that and make that change.
Actually, I have one comment. Can we make it to where if the governor's automatically extends or if a nationwide automatically extends, ours just follows it, supporting that?
Well, this is just a resolution encouraging people to wear face masks when appropriate until there's no pandemic, basically.
Okay,
or until
we don't need anything like that. Okay, good to go.
Yeah.
Jim, yeah, Lynn, ours is open-ended, although our closed date is when Brown County says it's good to go and we're safe. So I was thinking that it's possible the government, you know, there might be a court challenge or the governor might amend his, but we will continue to recommend and ask what we recommend until the county says it's all clear for us.
Perfect.
Okay. Any other questions or thoughts?
Hearing none, we have a motion to approve with the fixing of typos and the checking of the date, and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you for your hard work and everyone's consideration. Item number 8, action regarding resolution 2020-24, exemption to existing roadway width for Beaumont Street and East Kell. Mr. G.
At the Public Works Committee meeting last week, Wednesday, we had reviewed the proposed roadway widths for next year's reconstruction project. The recommendation from the Public Works Committee was included the proposed roadway widths. Best sidewalk along Beaumont and Rose Boulevard. The item included in the agenda is just specifically about an exemption to village code allowing us to move ahead with a roadway width less than what is required by our code. Village code requires on our local streets, residential local streets, a minimum a roadway width of 33 feet from back of curb to back of curb. We are proposing less than the 33 foot requirement on Culp and on Beaumont. What we're proposing on Culp and in Beaumont would be to match the existing width, which is 31 feet from back to curb to back to curb. On Beaumont, I'd like to also add that the bike and ped plan includes sidewalk. So tonight, I guess we'll have to get approvals through a number of village board meetings, and I'll have to bring back whether or not we want to construct sidewalk under next year's reconstruction project. We'll talk about the proposed roadway widths for Roselawn Boulevard. So I guess I'm looking for, I'm recommending to the village board to accept the roadway widths as currently presented, which are less than and that, again, that would be for Beaumont and Culp, which would be less than the minimum requirement provided by the code.
Okay, so you're looking to move the street minimum from 33 feet to 31 feet back of curb for Beaumont and East Kell.
Correct.
So basically you're just matching the existing and not making it bigger.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
So it's no change really, it's just what's in the code to start enlarging our streets, and it seems like a silly time to do it.
Agree, and keep in mind too, these are Culp Street is a dead end, very, very low traffic. A little bit more traffic on Beaumont. It is adjacent to St. Matthew's Church and school, but it is a residential street. No reason to widen these roadways.
Okay, thank you. Do I have a motion on this item? Trustee Green.
So moved.
Move to approve. Seconded by Trustee Dart. Any discussion?
I was just going to add that when we widen residential streets, a lot of times it just aids speeding up and down those streets, and that's one of our largest complaints by residential people, is we have long
wide runoff too.
Yet more runoff, more speeding. It just, wider streets don't fix any issues.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? We have a motion to approve and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. Action item number 9, action regarding St. Mary's Boulevard sanitary sewer lateral replacement project bid results.
Earlier this month, we opened the bids for the St. Mary's sanitary lateral replacement project. We had received 4 bids. The low bidder was Scott Lehmer's Construction at a bid amount of $83,394. It did come in slightly over what we had estimated. We had estimated plus $75,000, but it is a fair number. Overall, if you include this project along with the sewer lining project, we're under what we'd estimated. We had estimated an overall cost to improve the St. Mary's sanitary sewer at $150,000. With this cost and the work that was just recently completed, the sewer lining, which cost the village roughly $51,000, we're looking at roughly speaking $130,000 overall, about $20,000 less than what we'd estimated. I'd make a recommendation to award the contract to Scott Lamers Construction Inc. in the amount of $83,394.
Do I have a motion on this item? Trustee Green.
I'll move.
Second.
Seconded by Trustee Atwood. Any discussion? Keep up the good work, sir. Thank you. I think we have a motion to approve in a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. Item number 10, action regarding resolution 2020-23, compliance maintenance annual report.
Every year we're required to put together a report summarizing our maintenance and operational activities for our sanitary sewer collection system. It's done for the previous year. Overall, the Village Jones operates and maintains 61 miles of sewer. We have 2 lift stations and, roughly speaking, 1,300 manholes. I can go through the report if you'd like. I could touch on some of the major points. The DNR requires that the Village Board pass a resolution indicating that we've reviewed and approved it. So maybe I should point out some of the major points. I guess first of all, I'd like to thank Julie. She had helped with the financial information that was provided. The CMAR report that was sent out yesterday, that there was recently some minor changes made to that. It had amended the financial information in the report. I can go over that. If not, I'll go on to the next major item. I'll just go ahead and do that. The report summarizes what we had done last year, what some of our goals were. Last year, under our 2019 street reconstruction project, we replaced 5,000 linear feet of sanitary sewer, which included some high priority sewers that were old fire concrete pipe that had deteriorated and failing. Last year, we had televised over 4,800 feet of sewer pipe. The street department had a goal of cleaning 33% of our sanitary sewer system, and that was met. Under the 2019 street reconstruction project, we offered a voluntary program that provided an opportunity to the homeowner to remove and replace their private side lateral from the property line to the home. We're currently working on working with our neighbors, mainly the pier. We'd like to buy a better camera, and they have a more sophisticated camera. We're looking into that, but we would maybe possibly in the future jointly purchase that with a smaller community, not the pier, because they have their own, but maybe possibly Bellevue or Howard or Wamaco. One of the other things that we're actively looking for in trying to remove iodine. Last year we received a record amount of precipitation, 49 inches. And that broke the record set in 2018, which was 39. We're getting a lot of clear water into our system, and unfortunately it's being sent to new water, it's being treated. It's adding some additional costs, and the amount of a couple $100,000. So we're actively pursuing it. And this year, the same area's sanitary sewer improvement project. We lined 1,600 feet of sewer pipe, and in coming days, we're going to be removing and replacing laterals. So that definitely helps. Step in the right direction. The report includes future planning, and a lot of what I have in here we covered under the capital improvement plan. It just makes mention of our reconstruction projects, that we do that every other year. Next year, I would like to continue what we started on St. Mary's and improve the east half of St. Mary's, the sanitary sewer. The other thing that the report covers, and it is mandatory, is in 19 we did have a sanitary sewer overflow at one of our lift stations due to the flooding that we had on 14th and 15th of March. Are there any other questions?
I don't have any, but thank you very much for that overview. Any questions for Sean?
I have a comment. The job well done.
Thank you. Okay, so can I have a motion to approve Resolution 2020-23, reviewing and approving the compliance maintenance report? Trustee Harris, seconded by. Trustee Atwood, any discussion? Hearing none, we have a motion to approve and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Passes. Thank you very much, Sean. Action item number 11, sidewalk clearing policy.
This item we've discussed in July and August at the Public Works Committee meeting. It was a process that was started fall of last year. The continuous improvement, there was a continuous improvement project, the committee members had looked at our current policy, and there was a lot of discussion on whether or not the responsibility to clear the sidewalk should be the abutting property owner's responsibility or the village's. In all honesty, our neighbors, the other communities, put the responsibility on the abutting property owner. Our current policy in summary, from 0 to 3 inches, we go out and plow, clear village-owned properties, roundabouts, and currently school sidewalk routes. 0 to 3, all the walkies is the responsibility of the abutting property owner. My notes here. Greater than 3, we go and clear all of the walk, all of the contiguous sidewalk in the village. After we do our initial clearing, though, it's the homeowner's responsibility, abutting property owner's responsibility to keep free of snow and ice. Our code also allowed us, current code also allowed us to go out and do more frequent plowing when we felt necessary, mainly on the county and state highways. I had provided information yesterday afternoon I hope that maybe you had a chance to review at our Public Works Committee meeting on the 12th, last week, Wednesday, there were a couple of recommendations provided. There were really two options that were recommended. Before I get into those options, I'd like to quickly talk about, we have roughly speaking, 20 miles of sidewalk, and we've classified our public walk into five types. We've identified problem area walk. Every community has a private area sidewalk. But what is a private area sidewalk? We've defined that as Webster Avenue, Riverside Drive, Alloway Avenue, and it's problem area walk because mainly for three reasons. One, it's the sidewalk is abuts the back curb. On Webster Riverside Drive, there's four lanes of traffic, and when the county plows, they plow two lanes outward onto the sidewalk. Ideally, what you'd like to have between the back of the curb and inside of the edge of the sidewalk is a boulevard, proper width of anywhere between 5 to 6 feet to adequately store snow. The other challenge with primary sidewalk is the frequency at which the county plows. They're constantly coming through, even after the storm, multiple times after the storm to keep the gutter pan open. And every time they do that, they cover the sidewalk because the sidewalk is adjacent to the back of the curb. We have two roundabouts in Alloway, and it is the village's responsibility to clear the walk around roundabouts. We have school sidewalk routes, and that's further broken out into two types of sidewalk, school sidewalk routes and safe route to school sidewalk. Safe route to school sidewalk is sidewalk that was constructed under our Safe Route to School program, and we've undertaken one project so far. We have one that we're planning to undertake in the near future, 2022. But in 18, we constructed Safe Route to School sidewalk under the Webster Elementary Safe Route to School project, and that included sidewalk along Brookridge Street from Alloway Avenue to Libel, Woodrow Way, from Alloway to Alloway Avenue to Brookridge, and then from the school to St. Joseph Street. There was sidewalk along St. Joseph Street that was constructed around under that project from Libel to Webster, and there was walk constructed along Libel, just across from the Village Hall. We also have walk that has been classified as school sidewalk routes, and a lot of the walk that we have along Libel has been considered school sidewalk routes for whatever reason. There are other segments of our public walk that have been provided that designation. We have village-owned properties, that's self-explanatory, and then we have all other contiguous sidewalk, and that would be sidewalk along Green Avenue, Hoffman, Broadview, Longview Avenue. Just recently, in the 19th project, we built a sidewalk from Delahunt to on the north side from Delahunt to Libel. In 17, we built a sidewalk from just east of Webster to Delahunt. So we've got these different classifications, and it's important to describe that to you, because when we go through these options, you're going to hear about these certain sidewalks. So I provided some pictures of sidewalk along Webster Avenue, and I already mentioned that it's a challenge to maintain. And my purpose was to try to show you the challenge at hand. I don't know if you have the pictures, but if you do it, you know, I have a picture showing what the sidewall looks like after a 4 to 6 inch snow event. It's buried. You can't even tell there's sidewalk that it exists there. When we come through to clear it, we have to make multiple passes because of the consistency of the snow, slush, ice, the characteristics of the existing sidewalk, physical characteristics, uneven joints, in some cases sunken low back curb. If you don't get there right away, you can forecast it freezes. We have to come through. The first thing we do, we come through with a piece of equipment with a snowblower on it. We try to do our best to get as close to that sidewalk surface as possible, but unfortunately, we can't. What we try to do is just handle a majority of it, get it off, and then we come back and we based on the amount of snow we had that year, we blade it off and we'll blade it to the outside. If there's a huge windrow of snow, then we have to push it into the gutter and then blow it over the sidewalk. So my point is that it is a challenge. I wouldn't want to try to shovel. And I don't. You probably go through a plastic shovel every time you try to shovel your sidewalk after a significant storm, 3 inches or greater. The options that were discussed at the Public Works Committee were the following. Option one, less than 3 inches, village clears village-owned properties, roundabouts, and problem area sidewalk. That would include Riverside Drive, Webster Avenue, and Alloway Avenue. It would be the abutting property owner's responsibility to clear all of the other walk. That would be the school sidewalk roads. That would be the safe road to school and all the contiguous sidewalk. And when I say contiguous, sidewalk that's connected. We do have sidewalk at the north end of the village, gaps of it. No, we don't maintain that in winter. The approximate cost to do so is $30,000. And I want to point out that in the past, we didn't track the clearing of sidewalks separately from the streets. We just started that this year. The cost to under the current policy to clear the sidewalk during an average snow fall year is about $25,000. Option one would cost about $30,000, and as we continue to better track the cost, we'll have a better idea of how much it costs the village to clear. Option two. And I want to point out option two. It's with the exception of the problem area sidewalk, it would be what the continuous improvement committee had recommended. They made a recommendation of how we should move ahead with or how we should potentially modify the sidewalk policy and it consists of this: less than 6 inches. The village clears village-owned properties, roundabouts, and problem area sidewalk. Again, that's Riverside Drive, Webster Ave, and Alloway Avenue. It would be the abutting property owners to clear clear all other sidewalk. Safe route to school sidewalk, and all the contiguous sidewalk. 6 inches or greater, we'd go out and clear. We'd go out and clear all the public walk in that way. The recommendation provided by the Continuous Improvement Committee had recommended no change to the problem area sidewalk. They felt that should be left at 3 inches. So that's how this option differs from the CIA recommendation. The cost of this is about $25,000. Not much different than what we do now. Why is that? It's because we've under this option we've moved the problem area walk from a 3-inch threshold from to 0 to 3. We're going to go out regardless of the snowfall event. We're going to go out and clear it.
Oh, really? It's not 0 to 3. It's over 0.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, then I was just pointing out that the difference between this option and what the continuous improvement committee had recommended.
Okay. But so that option one is the village will maintain the problem streets or the problem sidewalks.
Any snowfall depth, yes.
Okay. I'm sorry I cut you off. Keep going.
I know this is a lot to take in, and we've talked about it in multiple Public Works Committee meetings. If you want to drop back, if there's additional information you need, I'll be more than happy to do that, but we really do need to make a decision for a couple of reasons. In the near future, there will be a public informational meeting, or there will be a mail that will go out to those along the Doty Safe Local School Project. I'd like to be able to answer questions about or provide information about the maintenance of sidewalk. Two, in our equipment replacement plan, we do have a purchase of another smaller utility vehicle to help clear sidewalk. And three, if we're going to implement any changes, we need to get the word out now. And if you guys would like to move ahead with the change, we need to talk about how to best implement that. Do we hold a public hearing to allow residents to come in and comment on this new policy? At a minimum, at the end of this, we want to make sure that the village code reflects the policy. Unfortunately, right now, it doesn't. The policy is different from the code. The code puts responsibility on the abutting property owner. I'm not sure why the two weren't. I don't know why the two don't match one another, but we'll get that cleaned up.
So are you looking for are we looking for a motion to change the ordinance or to change the policy or both? Well, we only have it on here as the policy. We can always bring it back.
Yeah. Yep.
Can I just ask a question?
Yep.
What's our goal?
Our goal? That's a good question. You know, Webster Avenue is a bus route. Green Bay Metro bus route runs up and down Webster Avenue. And for safety reasons, we want to make sure that sidewalk is clear, whether it be by the village or by ordinance. It is an enforcement problem because it's hard to maintain.
Yeah, Public Works, we've talked, and I wasn't at the last one, but we've talked about it before, and Webster Avenue and Riverside Drive are problem areas because the county trucks plow those, and they are continuously plowing. So unlike the side streets where we go out and we plow, and we may do it twice to clean up and stuff, these sidewalks are right up on the highway, the wide roads.
So the problem is they're not getting clean, and we want to make sure they're clean.
They're not getting clean. We want to make sure they're cleaned, and we also want to be fair to the property owners along those troubled walkways, because they can go out and do it, but then slush gets thrown up there again.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, I understand that problem.
So it's to have clean sidewalks, safe passage for our residents, and to be fair to the residents along those roads. That's my opinion.
If I may add from a continuous improvement, what we're looking at, and you have to understand that when you do a continuous improvement process, doesn't necessarily mean you implement a change or you will find there is a savings. But we wanted to identify what are the challenges, what is our current practice versus what is the ordinance, and make sure that it's consistent, because we weren't, they were not consistent. And so, you know, and we understood that there are some problem areas, i.e. Riverside Drive and Webster Avenue. And, you know, wanted to bring it to the forefront that it is expensive. And we're one of the few communities that really go out and do as much snow removal on sidewalks throughout a municipality as others do.
Well, thank you. And thank you to the committee for that, by the way. You have a question, Lynn, or a statement?
Actually, I just have a statement. You know, our sidewalks are public infrastructure, and especially along Webster Avenue, as we're looking at making that the village center, that being walkable is huge. I mean, I've lived right off Webster for over 20 years. I have no abutting sidewalk, so... However, I will tell you from walking along Webster, that is one icy mess, and problem is an understatement. So is Riverside. So as we're trying to be a more walkable, sustainable community and build a downtown and build out what we need to do to have a city center, I just think this is pretty important that we help take care of those, because it is an absolute icy mess once the county throws that back on there.
Okay, so we are looking to do something with the policy. So for discussion's sake, I'll make a motion that change the village policy to have the village maintain troubled, is that the term you're using, Sean, troubled sidewalks?
Troubled or problem area sidewalks.
Problem area sidewalks, which currently include Riverside Drive, Webster, Alloway Avenue, and I would add Brook Ridge at this point in time. Brook Ridge is a safe route to school, but it's right up to the curb.
No so tariffs.
There's no tariffs. They're going to have the same issue.
Great.
But the other, so that's my motion. Let's take care of the motion first. Does that cover everything that you were thinking, Sean?
We would, regardless of snowfall depth, we would go out and clear. Yeah. We would go out and make the initial pass. The homeowner still needs to provide assistance. They would have to go out afterwards and keep free to keep clear of ice and snow after we come through.
And obviously, we wouldn't go out right at the beginning to do it. We would wait because our current policy or code says up to 48 hours after the snowfall, I think.
So, 72. Yeah.
So we want to wait until it's there. Yeah.
I guess I was confused because over a period of time, we've changed it quite a few times.
Yeah, I know.
And I was just confused where we were going.
Okay.
So thank you. I get it.
Okay, to continue discussion, do I have a second on that motion? Trustee Green, thank you. I have further discussion on this, and that is nothing's going to be perfect, but I think this will provide for the safety. I think we should look at getting rid of this school route designation for sidewalks, because every sidewalk's a route in some way, shape, or form.
Agree.
Yes.
So, because that confuses things. Obviously, if something's mandated by the federal government because we're getting their money, that's a different story.
As long as we have an ordinance in place that puts the responsibility on the abiding property, we meet the
federal requirements.
The municipal agreement.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Okay. So that is my motion. We have a second, Chris.
Question, and kind of along the to follow up to Trustee Dart's comment that we've changed it a lot. we don't hand out many tickets for non-compliance, do we? I know we probably don't do any at all on these problem areas, but ones that are kind of fringe problem areas, do we do many tickets? What's the enforcement?
We do go out. Last year we had gone out and we provided a warning. This is your one and only warning. A second offense, you would get charged. You would get cited for not properly clearing your sidewalk.
The question is that pretty rare, or do we do a couple of dozen of those every big storm?
I would say that it's not rare along Webster Avenue because of the challenge.
Okay, so this is more work for your people, but it would make for better relations or take that enforcement out of it a little bit, maybe.
Yep.
Okay.
President Rapture, can I add something?
Yep.
What we want to do for the recommendation, again, kind of going back to our continuous improvement, was to get rid of the policy and make it the ordinance. Okay. So instead of us writing another policy and then we have to change it again, I think maybe the idea would be to eliminate the sidewalk policy, change it into ordinance with some of the language that you provided.
Okay, so what I will do is amend my motion to say we'll strike the policy and cover it under an ordinance and direct staff to draft it for approval at the next village board meeting.
Correct.
Trustee Atwood's on mute, can't get off.
Oh. Okay, you should be up. There you go.
There you are.
Oh, I felt like you were Barb. Not letting me talk.
I saw your lips moving, but
I just have one comment, Sean. What is our street supervisor's position on all of this?
That's a good question. I'd like him to explain that to you. I think he was okay with the existing policy.
Okay. I know Webster poses a challenge in the sense that there's really not a solution. You know, I mean, we do what we can, and then it's undone by, you know, the county trucks, because obviously they want to keep a clear roadway as well. So that's a toughie. Yeah, I get that. So, it's a challenge.
I guess I would. It is.
Anyway, before we continue discussion, I need a second on that amended motion.
Second.
Trustee Genrich, thank you. Okay, but go on, Sean.
Under your motion, are you then suggesting that at 3 inches or greater, we would continue to go out and clear all of the village sidewalk?
No. If there's snow on those sidewalks and we deem it necessary, I say we go out and do it. So above zero.
On the primary walk, yes. But
the others, we eliminate that service.
So there'd be no change then from the current policy at 3 inches. We as a village go out and clear all of the village sidewalk. You're not proposing any changes to that, correct?
When you say village sidewalk, we have
public.
Yeah, I am not making any change to that.
Okay.
Do you want to change to that?
Go ahead.
Does your committee want a change to that?
The Continuous Improvement Committee had suggested moving that from 3 to 6 inches.
And it was 6 inches up until 2017, and then it switched to 3 inches.
Okay, what are examples of village-owned sidewalk?
That'd be all of the public walk within the village, and that would be
Street.
Would be the school sidewalk routes. That would be the safe route to schools. That would be village properties. That would be the roundabouts, and that would be the primary sidewalk that we just talked about. It would be everything.
I'm confused.
Yeah, me too.
All right.
Last year, did we plow Webster?
Yes.
Over 3 inches or over six?
3 inches and greater.
Okay, it was a mess.
This year we're saying from zero on, we do this. Because
yes.
That's from the street.
Yes.
Absolutely. And Riverside was a mess. I mean, we seem to have a whole lot more of those cycles of larger snowfalls and icing up, and I don't know if that's a function of environment or how the county's doing things.
Okay, well, let's take these at one. So you've got the problem streets,
right?
Or sidewalks, we've discussed that.
Yep.
Village-owned encompasses everything, so I don't think we should discuss village-owned, but roundabouts?
Roundabouts would be our responsibility. It's the same as, just as you mentioned, village-owned properties would be no different than...
Yeah, but village-owned properties, you're throwing everything into that. You have problem streets.
No, properties that we own, for instance, the village hall, the community center.
Optimus Park.
Optimus Park, thank you, Brad.
Got it.
We have.
Okay, so not safe routes to school.
No. Correct. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yes. Village owned property.
John, are we looking to just change from option one to option two?
No. I think the main thing is that we're gonna. And the motion provided is that we're gonna take care of the problem area sidewalk, regardless. Of snowfall depth. Our policy points out, it talks to different snowfall events, and that it triggers when we go out and do a full plot.
Okay, so how does this sound? I made the motion that we would go out and plow problem area sidewalks as defined at zero or greater.
Okay.
And I would suggest we continue to do village-owned property at 3 inches or greater.
Well, we have to do our property regardless.
Right.
It's our property. So you have to separate. There's the problem areas, our village-owned property, we're going to go out and do if an inch, we're doing it because it's our property. It's our responsibility, just as it would be a resident's responsibility to do in front of their home. So that the other aspect would be any snowfall, we're doing village-owned property, roundabouts, problem areas. The question is, at 3 inches or greater, are we going to do the rest of the village like we have been in the past, or does that go to 6 inches or greater?
I'm okay with 6 inches or greater.
For Webster?
No, Webster's done no matter what.
The rest of the village is...
That's your problem.
Wait, guys. Please define the rest of the village then.
You're talking safe routes to school? You're talking Libel Street? As you put it, all other sidewalks in some fashion or another are a school route. So that's what they are. It's the Libel Street, it's... Longview.
That was sidewalk along Broadview. St. Joseph Street. Yeah.
Okay. So, to avoid confusion, we we don't want to say the rest of the village, right? We want to say what we have to identify those routes. So if you want to continue to identify those routes as village-defined routes to school, then
otherwise, it sounds like we're doing the whole village.
Yeah.
Right.
And which we did.
Which we are.
Well, yeah. we used to do the whole village.
At any snow?
No, at 3 inches or greater.
Wait. If we put in a sidewalk on Beaumont, we're going to do that at over 6 inches?
Yeah.
Yes.
If the policy changes, yeah.
Does it have a terrace?
It would. Yeah, if we build a sidewalk, it would have the proper terrace. But under the current policy, we would go out and clear at 3 inches.
Okay, I'll tell you what I'd like to see. My proposed motion is exactly as I stated. We go out and we plow, problem, sidewalks, and village-owned property. I don't recommend we do all other streets. But if the Continuous Improvement Committee believes that's important to do at 6 inches or greater, I'm okay with that.
President Rafter?
Yep.
I'm going to make a suggestion here, and I realize that there's been a motion and a second already.
Yeah.
I would suggest that we table this, have it put in writing, or have a map of the streets that we're talking about. For one, it completely confused as to what's been done. In fact, your motion that you just mentioned didn't include the roundabouts. We have the Robin streets, we have roundabouts, we have village-owned property, we have over 6 inches, over 3 inches, we have road above. I want to see it in writing before I make a vote.
I agree, and I tried to get that.
I think we have it. Excuse me, we have it. We don't have the map in writing.
No.
I mean, we have the options in writing, but it's still very confusing to me.
It is. I'd love to see a map in color of what we do at any snowfall, what we do at 3 inches, what we do at 6 inches, and I think that would take care of residential confusion as well.
Didn't you have a map in our packet,
Sean? Yeah,
with green and red drawing?
Yeah, if we could bring that up, I could do that now, but if for lack of time, the map really isn't going to change a whole lot, but I can try to do my best to make it a little bit clearer. But the map provided describes the different sidewalk types, and I would strongly suggest when we talk about this again that we talk off the map. Also included in the packet was the options. There was a Word document provided. On the top, it said sidewalk clearing policy. It summarized the current policy, and then it provided the options that were recommended by the Public Works Committee last week, Wednesday. But I know this is a lot of information. It isn't complicated, but to somebody that isn't familiar with it, it would be complicated. Whatever I can do to help make it a little bit clearer, I'm all for it. I've also, the information that went out yesterday, it also included the policy that was adopted in 2017, and I had included the Continuous Improvement Committee's recommendation along with what is currently in our code. And a day wasn't enough time for you guys to digest.
No, I just found it like an hour before the meeting, so I printed it and I was trying to go through it, and I just couldn't understand what I was looking at.
And
I don't ever deal with it, so.
Okay, let me ask a question. How do people feel about plowing sidewalks that are not village-owned, roundabouts, or troubled sidewalks?
I you know, I feel for property owners who might be in a tough spot, but that's factored into the price of your house. Gee, I've got a house where I don't have to shovel. Gee, we have a sidewalk and we may have to shovel it. That's factored into the deal, I think, so I'm not sure we have to apologize.
Lynn.
Sidewalks are public infrastructure. They are there for the public use. They are not there for the benefit of the homeowner in any respect. And when we look at problem areas with no terrace, I would challenge anybody to shovel Webster Avenue on a snowfall with then resulting ice. Walk the whole of Webster Avenue, and also the people on Riverside. You know, when we talk to them and we put in that crossing, there is a whole lot of confusion about that's a public crossing. I know it costs money. However, it's a public infrastructure piece. So I guess I am way in the camp of if it's a problem place and it is no terrace, that is above and beyond what I think a private homeowner should have to handle.
So what about if it is not a problem area or a street or a sidewalk with no terrace?
I could get behind 3 inches at that point, and we do above and beyond that. But, like, when you look on Brook Ridge, there is no terrace, and we've got mailboxes in the middle of that sidewalk.
Yeah, we all agreed on that.
Yeah.
On the problem streets. I'm talking about the streets that are not problem areas.
Yeah, and I was too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
For discussion purposes, can I add one other thing? Under the current policy, school sidewalk routes are cleared at starting at zero.
Is that part of the grant we received for making the safe routes to schools?
Yeah. For a sidewalk constructed under the Safe Route to School grant, yes. It's a condition of the state municipal agreement that either the community needs to clear the walk or ordinance needs to be in place to put the responsibility on the abutting property owner. We have, and I don't know how this has happened, but. On the map that I provided yesterday, it only shows the sidewalk, school sidewalks constructed under the Safe Route to School program. It's shown as a blue line. Now we have, I don't know how it occurred, but we have over the years defined other segments of sidewalk as school sidewalk routes, and they're being treated no different than Safe Route to School sidewalk. It's all of it is being cleared at 0 inches, something greater than zero. It's been the village's responsibility. We go out, we get a quarter inch or a one inch, a half inch or 1 inch. We go out and clear all of the school sidewalk routes, including the Safe Route to School sidewalk. And maybe that I can show beyond the map provided, beyond the Safe Route to School sidewalk, I can show all of the other sidewalk segments that have been defined as school sidewalk routes. And I think you're going to find that about 50% of the sidewalk 50% of the village's public sidewalk has been considered school sidewalk routes.
Part of the complexity of this whole thing is if we do every sidewalk in the village right now, right, after a certain height or depth, we have to put into the code then what a property owner would be responsible for and at what depth. So if we are going, let's give some guidance to Sean. If we were going to continue to plow all the other sidewalks, at what depth
Is it 3 inches or greater or 6 inches or greater? And Brad or Sean, the committee recommended six.
Six.
Six. Did the Public Works Committee agree with that? Or no, they gave two options.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So we can do a real quick round robin just to give them guidance. They can put together a proposed ordinance. You feel more comfortable with three or six or none? Trustee Atwood says
six.
Six. Why don't you draft an ordinance that uses sticks for that piece?
Okay, just so we're clear, the all other is pink on Sean's map.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so I withdraw my motion. And we will suspend talk on that until next, or we'll move it to the next meeting. Okay? Thank you very much. I know it's not an easy thing to get through, but we'll get through it. Item number 12, action regarding ordinance 2020-06, amending section 424-11.
Do we need a motion to table? No?
No, I withdrew my... Oh.
Versus postponing?
You withdrew your motion, so I'll make a motion to table.
To postpone, please. You want to postpone your motion?
Postpone.
Okay.
Sure.
Motion by Trustee Harris, second by Trustee Rafter. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Debbie. Okay, Sean.
This item, we're looking to gain approval to add no parking zones on the south side of Claude Alloway Terrace and Garland Street. You have the exhibits. You were provided the exhibits. On Claude Alloway Terrace, the no parking zone would be on the south side, beginning at the end of radius, extending 50 feet east. I don't know how much detail you want me to get into, but Claude Alloway Terrace is a narrow roadway. It's 23 feet from face to curb to face to curb. We currently do have a no parking restriction on the north side. However, it's not wide enough to allow, let's just call it three lanes of traffic, a lane in each direction and parking on the south side, at least adjacent to the Riverside Drive Alloway Terrace intersection. And what we're proposing here is just enough space to allow somebody to turn in the event that somebody's heading westbound on Claude Alloway Terrace, and there happens to be a vehicle parked on the south side, the person that's heading northbound on the outside lane of Riverside Drive can at least turn in and not get caught out into the intersection and causing a potential safety hazard. Garland Street, much of the same, but it's a little bit wider. Right now, there currently are no parking restrictions on the south or north side. It's 30 feet from face to curb to face to curb. What we're finding, though, people are parking on both the north and south side near the intersection. Under that scenario, though, it doesn't allow enough space to allow two cars to pass at the same time. What we're requesting here is actually a change from what was shown on the exhibit from 100 to 50 feet. Again, just enough space to allow somebody, if they're heading northbound on the outside lane of Webster Avenue, to at least get in. If they need to stop and wait for a car to pass and then continue eastbound. These proposed parking restrictions do require an amendment to our ordinance, and Debbie has provided that. There does need to be a change to what has been presented. it would be a change from 100 to 50 for Garland Street.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Do I have a motion on this item?
I'll move to approve.
Trustee Genrich, do I have a second?
Second.
Trustee Sampson, any discussion? We have a motion to approve with the change from 100 to 50 feet for Garland Avenue, for Garland Street, and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. Number 13, action regarding Doty SRTS method for public informational meeting.
The Doty Safe Out to School project, we've roughly speaking at 60% plan level. We're at a point where we need to do one of two things: hold a public informational meeting to make residents aware of the project and allow them a chance to comment, or provide out a mailer. Because of COVID, the DOT information about the project, and then an opportunity to comment, whether that be in writing, a form provided, or a phone call to myself or to the project manager from JT Engineering, or an email. I'm just looking for your direction. Do we want to hold a traditional type of meeting, a public informational meeting where people would be allowed to come in open house format? We'd have plans on display, a brief presentation, and then we'd open it up to questions. Or due to COVID, the other option provided by the DOT, because this is a DOT local led project, we can send out a mailer.
Is there any way we can do a Zoom meeting?
That option wasn't provided, but I could definitely look into that.
Because I don't see getting a large group of people together to look at plans, but I also don't see us not providing that to any residents who want it. So if there's some way for us to get those either on the website or emailed to those residents or a Zoom meeting, mailer option doesn't seem like it would encompass the scope that we would need.
Yeah, I was thinking much the same thing, Lynn. And you don't need a motion on this, do you? You just need guidance?
Yeah, sure, yes, yep. Because both options would meet the DOT requirement, yeah.
What I was thinking, how many do we have approximate number of homes along the route?
Quite a few. We're going to be constructing about a mile length of block.
Okay, yeah. So I would agree with Lynn, bringing people into a public setting just isn't a responsible thing to do at this time, but to be able to provide them the information, we could certainly put a page on our website with the, you know, or posting on our website with the drawings and everything else, send them a mailer to let them know what's going on, and then all the documentation can be seen on the website, and including the ability to get a hold of staff or whoever.
And that would be doable. That would be the mailer option. It'd be a handout that would have project-specific information. There'd be a map that possibly some plans, and then a form allowing the whomever village resident to comment. And that information could be placed it would be placed on the village website.
It would
also be sent. It would be mailed to everyone impacted by the project.
Okay.
Could they then sign up for an email update as to when a meeting would be held, and then they're also part of LA Buzz?
Excellent idea.
Good question.
One second. Chris, hold on.
Yep.
Yep.
Thank you.
To keep the project on schedule, a project of this size, you wouldn't have. We need to do one of two things soon, either the mailer or the public informational meeting, to keep the project on schedule.
Oh yeah, what Trustee Harris is suggesting is for future updates on the project, they can sign up for an update. So get the mailer out now, tell them to go to the website, and encourage them to sign up for the newsletters or give us their email so they can get updates on the project should you have to reach out to them.
Sure. But we currently do that now for our construction projects. On a weekly basis, we do our best on a weekly basis to provide an update on our webpage.
Cool. Thank you, Chris.
How hot are people going to get about new sidewalks? And just as a tactical matter, would there be value in having them, you know, set up an exhibit for a day? And if they want to swing by and you can deal with them one-on-one, is that any value between doing it all remotely and maybe there's more chance for misunderstanding? I don't know, but I just asked that.
But that's, you know, I would never turn anybody away. We have the plans. We could create larger exhibits and we could have them available for people to look at if they want to come in. That holds true on any project that we do for the village. If somebody has a question about a project, they're always welcome to come in and look at the plans, and we would take the time to do our best to help answer their questions.
Well, and then could you speculate, is this going to be controversial, and for how many people? Just a handful, if any? Or could there be some opposition?
Well, I guess it all depends on what happens with the policy, the sidewalk clearing policy. It can be a challenge. It can get heated because depending on what our sidewalk clearing policy is, they may not want to clear the walk. They may not want that burden. They may not find it's needed, and they may not want to clear it in the winter.
Yeah, and I don't have a strong recommend. I'm just saying factor that in as to how you want to handle this. If you think it's going to sail through, maybe a mailer and some online stuff is fine. If it's a little more controversial, maybe you do invite people to come in and talk to you, wearing their mask as is encouraged by LOA ordinance.
Okay. Trustee Dart, did you want to say something?
No, I just wanted to be unmuted.
Okay. I asked you. Trustee Atwood, do you have anything? Okay. Okay. So you have our guidance on that, Sean?
Yeah, I think so. I think a mailer would be acceptable. Put the information on our website. To have larger displays created to have available if anybody wants to come in. It'll be available in my office where we could live in the boardroom. And we'll continue to provide weekly updates when they're needed.
Sounds good. Thank you. Okay, item number 14. Does any of my fellow trustees have something they want on a future agenda? Hearing none, I will accept a motion to adjourn. Trustee Genrich, seconded by Trustee Dart. Any discussion? Thank you very much for a long but good meeting. We have a motion to approve and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. Have a wonderful evening.